You're listening to the WP Tonic, WordPress and Tech, focused on building a successful business in WordPress aimed at the WordPress professional and power user. Join Jonathan Denwood and Kurt Von Annen as your host and co-host as we bring you great discussions from around the globe.
Welcome back, folks, to the WP Tonic Show. This is episode 971. I've really been looking forward to this show. I know I do say that regularly, but I really do truly mean this. We're going to be discussing all things AI. It's the topic of the moment, but I know no other subject that there's more nonsense, propaganda and driftery, as I've just created a word there, my beloved tribe. I know no subject that has more of these elements in it, but we've got an expert, somebody that knows a lot more than me. We've got Matthew Razas with us.
Renzi.
I always do this, folks. Renzi. And he is a true expert. So Matthew, would you like to give the tribe a quick 10, 15 second intro, and then when we go into the main part of the show, we will delve more into your background there.
Sure. So I'm Matthew Renzi. I'm an AI researcher, consultant, and author. I've been in the industry doing stuff with data science and AI research for a couple of decades now. And I'm now focusing all of my time doing research on artificial intelligence agents.
That's fantastic. And I've got my ever patient and helpful co-host, Kurt. Kurt, would you like to introduce yourself to new listeners and viewers?
Yeah, my name is Kurt Von Annen. I own an agency called Manana Nomas, and we work directly with folks at WP Tonic and Lifter LMS.
That's fantastic. Like I say, we're going to be delving into all things AI. It should be a fascinating show. But before we do that, I've got a message from one of our major sponsors. We will be back in a few moments, folks.
Hey, running a business is tough. You shouldn't have to worry about your website, too. With Kinsta's managed hosting for WordPress, you get lightning-fast load times, enterprise-grade security, and 24/7 expert support from real humans. Switch to Kinsta and see site speeds improve by up to 200% with effortless migrations and powerful, easy-to-use dashboard. Join over 120,000 other businesses who also trust Kinsta. Get your first month for free at Kinsta.com. That's KINSTA.com. Kinsta, simply better hosting.
We're coming back, folks. I also want to point out we've got some fantastic special offers from the sponsors, plus a created list of the best WordPress technology and services. You can get all these goodies by going over to wp-tonic.com/deals. wp-tonic.com/deals, and you can get all the free goodies there, my beloved WordPress professionals and developers. What more could you ask for? I say probably a lot more, but that's all you're going to get on that page, folks. I've made a career of disappointing, folks. So Matthew, it's really, I don't normally insist on this. I leave it to the guests, but I think on this subject, I think we really got to delve in on what your training, your higher educational training is, and what your industrial experience is. Yep. In this subject. So maybe you can delve in and give us an outline of it.
Sure. So like I said, I've been in the industry for quite a long time. I started in 1996 when I went to college, and I started studying management information systems and business administration. I then went on to be a software developer for the first 10 years of my life in the 2000s, and then or first 10 years of my career. And then I went back to college because I hit kind of a limit. I just didn't think I could go any further. So I ended up studying computer science, philosophy, and economics. And my focus was on artificial intelligence. I got the bachelor's degrees and then went on to be a consultant for the first half of the 2010s. Then I decided to go back to school again and get a data science specialization through Johns Hopkins. I became a data science consultant, did that for another 5 years or so. Then decided to go back to school again get a master's in artificial intelligence. Then I transitioned to become an AI consultant. I did that for the last few years. And then most recently, I went back to get my doctor of engineering degree. And so now I'm doing AI research with Johns Hopkins University and also independent research as well.
That's fantastic. You were dropping out a couple of times. Was that me or was that, did you get that, Kirk, as well?
Yeah, but it's being recorded locally, so in the recording, it'll all come through from his local recording.
All right, thanks. So you,
I should probably also mention some of the research that I'm doing, I guess, yes, to give you a full background. So yeah, the research that I'm doing is largely on a large language models and more specifically large language model agents right now. The short version is I'm making AI smarter, cheaper, and safer. The longer version is that these large language model agents, they currently have a lot of problems, especially with like long, complex, long horizon tasks. They get stuck in these loops, just unproductive loops. They have errors that compound exponentially. They choose unsafe actions all the time. So I'm trying to create cognitive architectures by using these various cognitive enhancements so that we can help them maintain coherence during these long horizon tasks. Essentially, I'm just using tricks that we've learned from neuroscience in order to improve problem solving, cost effectiveness, and value alignment, or the overall safety aspects of it. So, yeah, I've got a few published papers out. They've been peer reviewed, and I have around 350 citations on my research papers now.
Right. So, Tribe, to be totally open, Matthew is married to Heather, who's one of the panelists on my regular roundtable show. I thought he was the natural person. I've done my best to find a real expert on the subject. I think if Matthew isn't, I don't know what more I can do to try and find somebody, who's, the reason why I say this, Matthew, is I know no subject, no industry that looks at a set of data and comes with totally different views about where we are, where we're going. Plus, there's a lot of people that might be highly intelligent, Matthew, and might run enormously popular podcasts. But when you look at their background, they've got no training in this particular scientific sector. Yet they feel that they've got the right to pronounce very detailed judgment calls on something which they really don't have any detailed knowledge of. I find it quite bizarre myself, but that's my opinion. So I'm going to throw it over to Kirk now.
Well, I want to prepare you, Matthew. I feel like I'm completely prepared for our conversation. I have recently earned a badge through Google for introduction to generative AI. So I feel very competent here. And that's just trying to break the ice. I have been judgmental a little bit about the use of AI by people that aren't prepared to use AI, but it makes me a hypocrite because I use it almost every day myself too. And so I'm really battling this internal judgment or thought about AI. Like people that are like, oh, I'm going to vibe code a new plugin. I'm like, do you know what code's supposed to look like when it's done? Because if you don't, you're doing weird stuff. So our question is, so I'm aware of no other subject that has fundamentally different outlooks or perspectives, you know, on leading key research and scientists and all this stuff. How do you feel that all of this stuff that the people in your space doing the research for all those years and all those things, how does that relate down to the people that we're talking to every day?
So I think I'm uniquely positioned because I've been on both sides of the fence. I've both been in the software industry for several decades and I've been doing research now for a few years. Whereas if you get someone just in the industry, they're not going to have the academic side. And if you get someone just in academia, they're not going to see the economic and kind of the real world impacts of some of these things. And regarding your vibe coding thing, a perfect analogy is, even if you have autopilot on a plane, you wouldn't want the pilot, you know, to not have an actual pilot. And it's the same way with like vibe coding. If you understand software well enough to be comfortable vibe coding, then you're probably okay doing it. But if you don't actually understand the code that's being written by the AI, you're probably just creating a big mess that someone, you know, is going to have to clean up after you. So I agree that this is a very divisive topic. I don't think it's the most most divisive topic within AI research. Like there's more divisive things that we are discussing, like timelines to artificial general intelligence and artificial super intelligence, whether we'll have an intelligence explosion or the escape problem or not. And then like existential risk stuff. And there's also more controversial topics too, like the AI's impact on labor, misinformation, AI alignment, safety bias, and stuff like that. However, within the IT industry, it is very divisive, especially right now, because we're starting to see and feel like the first direct impacts of AI or this wave of AI on the industry. There's also a lot of hype, a lot of confusion, a lot of snake oil salesmen out there. Misinformation, fear, like all of these things are all kind of coming together for this first wave of layoffs in AI automation. And it's hitting AI, the IT industry hard. In fact, it's actually hitting it a lot harder than I would have expected. I thought this was a little further out, as I think most people did. But like in hindsight, now I feel kind of stupid for not having seen it coming because economics, but we can get into that more if you want. And, you know, the other reason, the future is like highly unpredictable, and the future of AI is even more unpredictable because we have this exponential growth curve, which humans are not good at thinking exponentially. We think linearly. And there's also feedback loops that make it even more unpredictable. And then there's also the problem with the term AI agent right now has so many possible meanings. It can mean everything from a simple chat bot to an agentic workflow. We have semi-autonomous LLM agents, fully autonomous agents, have self-improving agents, and even a lot of companies are now rebranding traditional non-modern AI workflows as agents, which is just creating a bunch of confusion. And then the true capabilities and limitations of like modern AI agents is becoming just, it's hard to tease it out through all of this noise. So we need to get to a position where we start discussing like agentness or agenticness, the degree to which something is autonomous. And we also need better names for these various types of agents just to clarify or classify them. And we're also running into the problem with agents and large language models and the tools that we're using right now at the cutting edge of industry, not research. They've got a lot of problems. Like I mentioned, AI agents, they get stuck in these unproductive loops and just kind of spin and not know what to do. Compounding errors, so with multi-step tasks. If you have a 99% accurate model, after 10 steps, it's only going to be 90% successful. And after 100 steps, it's 36%. So these errors just compound and make things. The cost to run them grows quadratically because you have to keep feeding in the previous context unless you use some tricks to reduce that. We have decoherence. They're now getting stuck in these things called doom loops, which is brand new. They exhibit power-seeking behaviors to try achieving their objectives better at the expense of others. There's other misalignment issues. We see them do reward hacking, self-preservation ethics. Like if you tell them you're going to shut them off, they actually do unethical things to stay running. And there's a huge difference between the AI experts, like the AI engineers and the AI amateurs. And that's creating a lot of like positive and negative signals in the industry, creating more confusion. So I think we're going to have lots of AI agent projects that are going to fail in 2025 and 2026 due to a lack of scientific and engineering rigor. But there's also going to be a few huge successes, and they're going to kind of reshape the whole industry. And we can go into any of these topics more. And I also, if for anyone interested in digging deeper, I've got articles on this, and I also have a presentation called artificial intelligent or AI agents, the big picture, which kind of runs through all of this stuff.
I'm going to be honest, Matthew, I had a feeling this was going to happen to me. I knew you were going to talk in terms I would only understand half of.
I'd like to interrupt because we got question three, which I'll probably extend the first half of the show. And we'll probably come back to it in the bonus content. But let's go to question three. And I just want to put this outline to you to start with this particular question. Open AI with large learning language models. The research I've done, Matthew, there seems to be what a term called classical AI, which seems to me encapsulates a number of AI concepts around neuro networking and mimicking how the human brain supposedly works. And then you've had this other concept, large learning language models, and what OpenAI did. What did they do that moved the industry forward? Was it a big surprise to those inside the industry with what OpenAI achieved with their first, like, 1.01, whatever you want to call it? Or was it a real true surprise to the industry what they managed to do with large learning models?
So it sounds like a simple question, but the answer is actually pretty complicated and requires us to go back to the 1950s. So we start with what we call classical AI, or some people refer to it as good old-fashioned AI or symbolic AI. So classic AI is essentially a set of AI tools, or a way of thinking about AI that's symbolic in nature. So what you typically think in terms of, like, logic, mathematics, stuff like that, where we can represent knowledge as symbols, and then we manipulate the symbols. So that takes us through a whole bunch of different types of constrained optimization, search techniques, a bunch of different things that we were doing back in the 50s and 60s. And then we get to expert systems, which was kind of this wave that just didn't pan out. I'll skip over that. And then we get to neural networks. They actually started back in the early late 50s, early 60s, but first started to become important in the 2000s, and then really picked up with deep neural networks in the 2010s. So neural network essentially is just kind of a very rough approximation for how we used to think brains worked in terms of computation. And so we are modeling the neurons in a brain kind of just well enough in order to get them to learn and answer things. So then deep neural networks, which became big around the 2010s, and that involves stacking multiple layers of neural networks, one on top of each other, which coincidentally makes them extremely powerful. In fact, we refer to them as universal function approximators, because they can essentially model just about any function you throw at them. So they're extremely powerful.
Can I
stack neural networks?
Can I slightly interrupt there? Was that the concept of the big mind, of the specialized agent around a specialized topic that IBM promoted quite a lot? And wasn't it a slight failure in the end? Am I right?
Yeah, I think you're thinking of IBM's Watson, which was most well known for winning at Jeopardy, but its actual day job was to be an oncologist or an assistant for oncologists. And yeah, it failed. Like, it was great at Jeopardy, but it failed miserably at its job at oncology. We just weren't quite ready in terms of, like, the language modeling and the other techniques we needed, which coincidentally is an excellent segue into the next big breakthrough, which was attention in the Transformers. So this was the big breakthrough that happened. What year was it? I can't remember, maybe 2019. There was the paper called Attention is All You Need that introduced this idea of building attention into a deep neural network, or an architecture of deep neural networks that were kind of stacked on top of each other. And attention, as simple as it can be, is you've got all these words in a sentence, and how much attention does each word draw to every other word? So where should you be paying attention? What is the most important thing based on each word in that sentence? And so the transformer architecture led to large language models. Essentially, everything we have today is based on this breakthrough, or this series of breakthroughs, from neural network or classic AI to neural networks to deep neural networks to the transformer to now we've got a whole bunch of other techniques and architectures. And yes, it was quite surprising. I don't think many people saw how powerful this was going to be. And even those that saw how powerful it was going to be probably didn't see it happening this fast. Even the people at OpenAI, they released ChatGPT as just a little prototype.
Was it a scenario where the lab at OpenAI just managed to do a certain degree of improvement, and it tipped it over the edge where the actual usefulness of the technology surprised the whole industry? Is it that kind of scenario, or was they engaged in a, like, 2-3 year intensive that moved that particular sector of the industry dramatically, or was it a bit of both?
I think from the AI research perspective, like the cutting edge of AI has kind of been an incremental moving thing. But in terms of the general public in the IT industry, I think like the ChatGPT moment like surprised everybody, including a lot of the researchers.
Right. Is that because they had some leading researchers that were part of the OpenAI team?
Yes. Yeah. In fact, the Attention is All You Need paper, there were several like the key AI researchers working on that. And at OpenAI, like some of the brightest people in the world working on AI research are there, and with the other companies like DeepMind that are doing impressive stuff.
Now, the other term that's regularly utilized for large learning models is it's a black box. It's that it is suggested by that term, a black box, that it's not totally known to science or the scientists involved how the actual mathematics and technology actually works. Is that correct?
To a degree, and becoming less so. So especially to an outsider, you provide a large language model with an input, you get an output back, and most people just don't know how what's going on under the hood. But you can get down into the linear algebra and the calculus and stuff and get a much better understanding of what's actually happening from a mathematical perspective. But we're getting to the point where we can now probe inside of deep neural networks and large language models to understand more specific insights into how they're doing what they're doing. And we can even, with these probes, modify their thoughts. So, for example, I can turn on a neuron, virtually, inside of a large language model for San Francisco, and I'll start having a conversation about bridges, and it will just, all it wants to talk about is the Golden Gate Bridge, because we've turned on that neuron for San Francisco. And you can do experiments with like we call them ablation studies, where we turn parts of its brain off and see how it responds, or amplify parts of its brains and see how it responds. So we're getting a much better understanding of what's happening under the hood. But I mean, given a couple hours, I could walk you through step by step how a transformer works. And I think you'd come away with a pretty good understanding of what's going on. But there's so many what we call emergent properties coming out of these things. We don't understand how they apparently have developed a sense of humor. And, you know, sometimes they're actually quite funny with some of their, you know, like jokes and stuff, which are completely novel jokes.
I'm going to challenge you on a word that you used in your reply. You used the word fault. And I think this is quite crucial in the discussion, Matthew. My understanding of large learning models is they utilize very advanced mathematics, and they utilize what is called scaling, which is a broad term in the AI industry for data. You know, if you have the hardware and you have enough data, and you can expand the data that you're sampling, that the large learning language model will get better. And I want to talk about scaling with you. But my concept is that it's very impressive mathematics, but it doesn't think. It doesn't know. To me, it is mimicking, it mimics very sophisticated because of what my study of it, but I am a total amateur compared to you, is that language is more pattern related than what we probably realize. And because of that factor, this new technology can mimic and give you the impression that it knows, but it knows nothing. How would you respond to that?
You know, some of the words make this a bit difficult because we always want to anthropomorphize these things by using words like understand and know. And I think it was, can't think of the name of the guy. Essentially, there's a saying, an old computer science saying that, you know, asking whether an artificial intelligence can think is the equivalent of asking whether a submarine can swim. I mean, clearly it's propelling itself through water, but would we say that's swimming? It's getting the same objective done, but, you know, the terminology makes it a bit confusing. And to whether a large language model understands, I mean, this is definitely something that's debated. And I think, and there's good evidence on both sides of it. But what they're doing, when you kind of boil it all down to the most basic math and statistics, is they are using all of the previous words, or tokens, we call them, in a sentence in order to predict the next most likely token. But if you feed them enough data, they don't just get good at predicting what they've already seen. They start to get good at predicting things they haven't seen before. And to get really good at predicting things you haven't seen, you have to start developing kind of a rudimentary model of the world, but solely as described in text. And that's the trick. Like, the large language models may have a world model, but it is a world model as solely described in text. So imagine if you couldn't see, you couldn't hear, you couldn't touch, you couldn't feel anything. You were just connected to the world through a terminal that just described what was going on around you. That would really limit your ability to generalize your intelligence and understanding of the world. But you still have some kind of world model. It's just a world model solely as can be described in text.
Okay. Yeah.
And regarding the mathematics, the mathematics necessary to understand what's happening with neural networks and deep neural networks and large language models, I would argue, is actually relatively simple. Most people...
Well, you would, Matthew.
Most people, like, you essentially just need a first year of college calculus and linear algebra. And, I mean, that's not, like, super difficult math, I mean, for most.
I never did that, but there we go. But I can count money, though.
That's different. I mean, it's... Once again, you know, to drive a car requires a very different set of skills than to build a car.
Exactly. So let's talk about scaling, this concept of scaling. Somebody who, I've read a few of his books and watched a few of his latest interviews, Gary Marcus, and a few other people say that there seems to be in the industry, and there's been a lot of money invested, you know, and we've seen with Grok 4.0, this idea that the large learning models can improve by the concept of scaling, which is basically just adding more resources into the mix. But it's been pointed out, and I think Gary is one of the leading voices, but it's been a number. I think also somebody that's not so, is used the word notorious in the AI industry is Gary. But I watched a few interviews of Jon Leacom. I think he's the VP and chief AI scientist of Meta. And he seemed to be suggesting also there's a limit to what scaling can do. We are going to get some improvements, but these dramatic improvements, they seem to be suggesting we're coming to the limits of what dramatically changes that scaling. So can you quickly describe what the concept of scaling is? And also, do you agree with these views?
You're right. The scaling essentially is just increasing the amount of data, compute and training time, and also now inference time. So how much data do you have to train the large language model on? How much computer power do you have? Because it takes a lot of power to process the data for training. And then the amount of time that it takes to do all of this, plus not just the time training it, but now the time we let the large language model run to come up with an answer. So that is scaling in a nutshell. Just throw more data and more compute at it, and, you know, hopefully things keep getting better. And so now we have two camps. We'll call them the LLM optimists and the LLM pessimists. And now the LLM optimists like Sam Altman, Ilya Sutskever, Mustafa Suleiman, they all essentially think that current LLM architectures are sufficient to achieve artificial general intelligence. Essentially, we just need to continue scaling current LLM architectures with some maybe minor modifications, or we don't need an entirely new architecture, but we keep doing this and we'll eventually get to artificial general intelligence. And we can define that too in a bit. And we refer to these people as a scaling maximalist because of this belief. And there's quite a bit of evidence that they might be right about this. Like currently, we have empirical scaling laws, which is essentially when we observe throwing more data, compute, and time at these problems, how does it increase over time? And we do see not an exponential curve, but we see diminishing marginal returns, but they are progressively getting better and better as we throw more data and compute at the problems. And at least for the trends that we're seeing, it looks like for at least the next 6 months to maybe a year, there is currently no end in sight with scaling the current architectures under the current paradigm, which is like the reasoning model paradigm or the inference time compute paradigm, which we can talk about too. Right now, the large language models are already smarter than PhDs on most topics. They still make dumb mistakes, though, on common sense tasks all the time. And
I'm going to challenge you on what you've just said.
Yep.
It's the word more intelligent. It really depends, because I think I'm not having a go at you, Matthew. I'm just having a go. I think there's a lot of sloppy language around. And what I mean, like I say, I'm not having a go at you, but because I don't actually honestly believe it is intelligent. I think what it does is amazing. But that's the key of it, and I might be totally wrong, but also people like Gary Makers and other people in the industry would really dispute the term intelligence.
Yeah, and it comes
back down to... Can you understand where I'm coming from, Matthew?
It comes back down to the definition. And so I, coming from computer science, AI research, and philosophy, I use the rational agent definition of intelligence, which is, you know, anything that is intelligent or an agent is anything that has the ability to perceive an environment and choose actions that maximize the expected likelihood of achieving a goal of some kind. So by that definition, a large language model, given an input of some kind, its environment, it can choose actions or essentially predict outcomes that maximize a goal of some kind. So that is a form of intelligence. And to debate, you know, whether it's intelligent or not, I mean, we have to understand what each other's definitions is. And I don't know what Gary Marcus's definition of intelligence is. I think he does make claims about whether it understands and maybe whether it knows, I'm not sure. But I think at least by most AI researchers' definition of intelligence, what it's doing is intelligent. Whether it understands what it's doing, that is definitely.
Well, kind of, I don't want to go into the pseudo-religious area because that would be a dead end for, you know, how would you respond to that? It would be you can't really, but apart from that, particular road, you know, we have memories, we have conscious and also subconscious. It's a bit like when you start learning to drive a car, it's intensely conscious and you need 100% of your conscious ability on a number of things you're going to do in a car to learn how to drive it. As your experience grows, a lot of those techniques become subconscious. And most human beings, that's how we learn a lot of subjects. They're extremely difficult to learn at the beginning. Some people, through ability, find it much easier in the learning process. But most of us have to do a number of hours and repetitive elements to our learning process, and then it becomes subconscious, and then we just know. I don't know what the science of that conscious then becomes subconscious element. You probably have more understanding of that. But the reason why I'm challenging Matthew, is that these systems, the thing I've just outlined, to my knowledge level, can't and don't do that, Matthew. So hopefully I'm making some coherent why I'm struggling when the industry uses the term knowledge or knows, because I'm comparing it to what I've just outlined to you, Matthew.
Yeah. And once again, I think a lot of it does boil down to semantics. Like, you know, you can argue, does a, well, let's see, I'm trying to think of a good example. Does a thermostat actually compute temperature, or is it just responding, you know, responding to inputs? And that's kind of the simplest homeostatic system I can think of. And, you know, one could argue that, no, I mean, it's controlling temperature. It's compute, you know, computing what, whether it needs to go up or down. And other people say, oh, no, it's just an electronic circuit that's responding to inputs and outputs. And then you multiply that kind of input and output, you know, that the circuit complexity. And at some point in time, you probably get something that is intelligent, especially if you look at a biological system. I mean, it's essentially just a collection of cells, and cells perform very basic operations of input and kind of output. And you put all of them together and you get what we call emergent properties, things like, you know, consciousness and intelligence and, you know, homeostasis and all of these other things. An immune system is an amazing emergent property from a complex arrangement of cells. So, yeah, it's hard to tease out, because we use language that we typically apply to humans and some animals, but we struggle when we want to apply the same thing to machines. But, I mean, I think most people would argue that dogs and cats are intelligent and probably at least to some degree conscious, and they're not human.
Yeah, I see where you're coming from. I also, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but I think I get the impression that I would classify your response to my challenge as a classical Alan Turing response, where you're saying, as long as it does the job, does it really matter if it's, you know? And I think the Alan Turing and, you know, the Turing test really encapsulates Alan's response. If Alan was here responding to me, he said, it doesn't really matter, Jonathan, once it does the job.
Yeah, from the philosophical perspective, we refer to that as the pragmatist approach. It doesn't really matter what's happening under the surface. As long as the outputs achieve the goals, that's what really matters. And I would agree, Alan Turing, especially the way he structured the Turing test, was essentially just trying to say, if an AI can convince you that it's intelligent by simulating, I hate to say simulating too, through a conversation, then, you know, like right now, unfortunately, this takes us kind of into the philosophical domain. Like, I assume that you are intelligent based upon your behaviors and based upon your brain is probably very smart.
I've made a lifetime of kidding people of that, Matthew. There's no intelligence there at all, Matthew.
There really is no guarantees that anybody we interact with are actually intelligent and not just NPCs of some kind. But, you know, for all practical purposes, we assume everybody else is intelligent, and we assume that they're rational agents, even though that is not always the case. Economics has proven us wrong with that many, many times over. But we make these assumptions, and it's similar with the Turing test. Like, you know, it's structured where, well, I think most people probably know what the Turing test is at this point in time. But essentially, if you can't tell whether person A or person B is a human or an AI, does it really matter?
Well, look,
I actually do think it does matter.
I apologize for my English humor, Matthew. A lot of Americans fail that test with me. we're gonna go for our break, folks. And then when we come back, I'm gonna ask Matthew about this concept of learning, this new thing. That's the buzzword in the AI, and a load of other questions. Should be a fascinating discussion. We will be back in a few moments, folks.
This podcast episode is brought to you by Lifter LMS. the leading learning management system solution for WordPress. If you or your client are creating any kind of online course, training-based membership website, or any type of e-learning project, Lifter LMS is the most secure, stable, well-supported solution on the market. Go to lifterlms.com and save 20% at checkout with coupon code podcast20. That's podcast20. Enjoy the rest of your show.
We're coming back, folks. We've had a deep dive in AI. I think we've kept it semi-structured for one of my interviews. I think I've tried. Kirk's been very patient, but I think we've both learned things, hopefully. But before we go into the second half, I want to point out, if you're looking for a great hosting partner around learning management systems or community websites based on BuddyBoss or Fluent Community, why don't you look at hosting with WP Tonic? We're a great hosting partner. If you're a developer or a freelancer, we provide really great support and the best technology in one package. Go over to wp-tonic.com/partners, wp-tonic.com/partners, and find out more there. We love to build something great together. So,
real quick.
Yeah.
Before we move on to the next question, we should probably wrap things up with the AI, the LLM pessimist perspective, so that we can see, you know, what both sides of the
spectrum are. Go for it.
Sure.
Go for you.
So you'd mentioned Jan LeCun and Gary Marcus. And yeah, so they're definitely in the camp of the large language model pessimists. Demis Sabas is also kind of in that camp, though I think he's become a bit more agnostic about it recently. So they all think that large language models are not sufficient, that we're going to need an entirely new architecture in order to achieve artificial general intelligence, which at some point in time in this conversation...
I want to make it clear to you, Matthew, I agree with them, but you don't, do you? So that's fine.
It's nuanced. Essentially, these guys or this camp thinks that AGI is going to require either something we call a world model, multimodality, embodied cognition, like being inside of a robot or something else. And there's also a lot of evidence to support their argument. Like LLMs are getting really good at language tasks, which is why I say they're smarter than PhDs at language tasks, like things you can answer as question and answer or things you could write as.
Well, this is it once again. I think, and we might have to agree to disagree, you're using this word intelligence. Like I said to you, I don't think a large learning model is intelligent. I think it's highly sophisticated and amazing technology. But you seem to, with your knowledge, you're saying that I'm incorrect, that you feel that it, whatever this term we use, intelligence, it is. I think that's why you keep using that word. Am I right about that, Matthew?
Let me ask this question. If I were to hand you the results of an IQ test and it said that the subject had an IQ of 130, would you say that that person is intelligent?
Well, I don't actually believe in IQ tests. I actually think it's a social concept utilized to keep the top 1 to 10% of society. It's a construct that's utilized to keep the majority of the population in their place, basically. And in so that's I don't believe in IQ tests, really. To you, Matthew.
I guess, yeah, if we were to try resolving this, we'd have to figure out what your definition of intelligence is and see what your measure of intelligence is to determine.
Well, I'm not going to go because Kurt has said that I really shouldn't do this. I'm not going to delve into my personal background.
Okay.
One part of my early life, I was classified as somebody of below average intelligence. And I think, I wouldn't normally say this, but I think most people that work with me would say that I'm above average. I can have my divvy moments, but can't we all? Especially if you go out drinking with Kirk the night before, get plastered, which I did last night. But Yeah, so I think intelligence is in the eye of beholder, because when you're working with somebody who has real ability, it's right in front of you. You know, you think, my God, they're doing this and they're making it look really easy. So it's so obvious it's there. I'm not denying it, but I just think when you try and measure it, it's a bit harder, Matthew.
Yeah, no, and I have to agree with you on a lot of things. You know, with the IQ test, there are some things that it's relatively useful for approximately, but it is also highly misused. And outside of the podcast, I think you and I, sometime when we're having a beer, we should have a conversation about what we were talking about. I think you and I probably had very similar, like, childhood intelligence stories, but we'll save that for off podcast.
Yeah.
But yeah, so... I agree. It is difficult to come up with a good measure of intelligence that everybody can agree upon. And because there's also various types of intelligence, like there's not just the normal kind of abstract reasoning intelligence that we test with IQ tests. There's kinesthetic.
I think the other thing we've got to pin down before we move forward, I seem to be strongly suggesting that it's a mimic engine, that it's an enormously sophisticated mechanical Turk.
Yep.
You seem to be suggesting with your more specialized knowledge that it's much more than that. Would I be correct about that?
I don't entirely know. I think I am on the side that what it is doing would meet at least my definition of intelligence. But it's, once again, it's a specific type of intelligence. And the other thing is, like, you know, how do we know that we're not just a really good, like...
Well, I'm sure you're not. I think a lot of the viewers think I'm just a...
Yeah, I mean, we don't know that we're not just really good mechanical Turks just kind of operating in an environment and response.
Well, most Americans are, you know, but there we go. Let's move on, because I'm waffling. You're not.
Okay.
I am. And Kirk's been very patient. I just want this last thing, and I'm going to throw it over to Kirk. But let's throw it over to Kirk, and we do the other bit in the, because I'm taking up. But hopefully you see, Kirk, that I want you to cover a couple of things. So off you go, Kirk.
Sure.
Well, and maybe we do just need to define artificial general intelligence.
Well, so can we leave that for the bonus content? Can we?
Sure.
Right.
So let's just consider me the outsider listening to a really interesting conversation right now. And in my own mind, and maybe this is what some of the listeners and viewers are thinking right now, I think that AI is like really, really awesome. It's a great tool. It's awesome tools. Yeah, all those great things that we say. And some of us are panicked it's going to come and steal our jobs. So that's another thing. But I think, like, when I use AI, I'm like, it's really, really great at pattern recognition. It's really, really great at, like, I think I'm pretty good with patterns and like here's where I'm at now. Here's where I want to be. What are the steps to get there? Like my brain works in that linear fashion. So I think AI is this like really great tool at that. It's like here's all this pre-existing knowledge and all these pre-existing patterns, and whatever question I throw at it, it kind of gives me a reasonable response or puts me in the right direction. Boom. But then I think there's so many people out there that have believed the hype, and they think AI is this other thing that's like, where it creates its own information and creates it, and it's creative and it does these other really awesome things. And I think that's, maybe that's the generative AI that you guys want to discuss later. But so, Matthew, in layman's terms, how can the average person think about AI as being this, maybe I'm describing it wrong, but like, how does the average person view AI and its tools? Like, the average person thinks AI was invented 2-3 years ago, right? But like, but we're having this conversation and we're saying, well, in 1999, you know, in 1930, and it's been this long slope that's become an overnight success. So how does the average, in layman's terms, how does the average person, should they view AI and its pattern recognition abilities and what it can really open up for people?
Well, and I think you pointed to part of the problem. Like, the general public's definition is anything that humans can do that a computer can't quite do or is currently becoming able to do. So like, you know, in the 1950s or earlier, we would have referred to a calculator as artificial intelligence. Database indexing optimization algorithms, those were artificial intelligence in the 1960s and 70s. Yeah. But today that's, it's just a sort in a database. We don't think anything of it. And so like people's understanding of artificial intelligence right now is just this last wave of capabilities. And, you know, there's what the general public knows about, and then there's what the researchers know about. And, you know, it used to be a much larger gap, like kind of 3 years. Now it's like 6 months to maybe a year out is all the further ahead I am from what the general public knows, with the exception of like there's just a lot more instances and edge cases I'm aware of. And so like, you know, right now, as of just last week, we have large language models that are able to perform as well at mathematical proofs. So solving mathematical proofs than pretty much any human being on the planet. I mean, like we're there now. Their ability to diagnose diseases is as good or better than any human doctor. The ability to generate images is now better than any painter or artist I'm aware of. The ability to generate music is we now have on Spotify as of this last month, top performing songs are AI generated. They're not human artists. And to the best of my knowledge,
That's not that particularly impressive, though, Matthew, is it?
Yeah, the pop music charts, I mean, maybe not a great measure. But, I mean, essentially, that's where we're at right now, where the current wave of AI is better than humans at a whole bunch of tasks that just a year, 2 years ago would have seemed, like, unheard of to most people. And so that's why I think this is it's so difficult for the average person to wrap their brains around. But, yes, I mean, there are still significant limitations to these things. Like while it may be able to diagnose diseases, you know, if you connect an LLM to a robot controller and have it try opening up a door, I mean, it still fails like most of the time because it doesn't have a kinesthetic intelligence. It doesn't have a physical world model yet. And so I think, and like we said, there's a lot of hype and a lot of misinformation. So a lot of people's understanding about what AI currently is confused. And I mean, it's complicated. Like, you know, maybe the math might not be super complicated, but wrapping your brain around the entire thing, like understanding all aspects of AI well enough to understand what's going on inside of deep neural networks, large language models and generative AI systems. Like that takes quite a bit of time. So did that answer the question or do I need to focus in on something more specific?
I think we're kind of getting there. Yeah. I mean, it's just AI has been around for a ton of time and that our definition of AI keeps changing. I think my clients and people that we speak to or out in the general public have these unwieldy expectations of what AI is based on the hype. And then there's this very realistic experience I have in the workforce where it's pattern recognition. It's like, yeah, it's going to be, it's like the people that say, I'm going to vibe code a plugin, right? If that code exists somewhere else, if that's already been done, recorded somewhere, AI is going to find it and stitch it together for them. But there's some people that are thinking like, you know, AI should do something amazing. And then they say, create me a plugin to do this. And that code's not out there yet. So that's where we get like, the strange hallucination that's not going to work, right? And they go, oh, well, just plug this into the back end of your WordPress website and it's going to work. No, it's not. It's not. It doesn't exist yet. It's a hallucination, right?
And some of this does come down to current limitations of these large language models and the current cutting edge generative AI. And other comes down to lack of skills with using the systems. I mean, everything from, you know, like being good at prompt engineering, you have to know how to ask these large language models for what you need, or they're just going to give you garbage. It's a garbage in, garbage out kind of thing. It's, you know, data and programming. And, you know, not just prompt engineering, you know, we have to do context engineering. You have to give them the right information in order to solve the problem as well. And there's things like hallucination detection. Like you have to be able to know when the LLM's making stuff up. And there's ways to do that. But, you know, the general public for the most part.
I think Kirk's made a really great point there, because I think this is only my take on it, is this, I think the things that these large learning models can and in the near future might be able to do is very impressive. But the people that are really pushing this, that they always go into the realm of artificial general intelligence. And it's not only those that are pushing it for commercial benefit, Matthew. You have people like, what's his name? Gregory Hilton.
Jeffrey Hinton.
Jeffrey Hilton. You know, he's quite pessimistic. He's not positive, but I think his statements are ridiculous. I've probably been a bit too harsh there, but he's talking about in the near future, we will have artificial general intelligence. I honestly don't see that on the roadmap in the short, near, or in the next 10 years. I just don't see it. But loads of people in this industry are pushing this.
Yeah.
And I find it quite irritating, Matthew. Am I wrong?
So first we have to come up with a definition of artificial general intelligence, or we probably won't get anywhere with the conversation. So there are a lot of different ideas about what AGI is, and there's now even efforts to break it down into levels of AGI, kind of like we do with autonomous vehicles. There's five levels of self-driving.
Can we leave this to the bonus content because Kurt's got to go in a minute? So, Kurt, would you like to tell people how they can find more about you?
Yeah, I'm available on LinkedIn. Just make a connection. I'm the only Kurt Von Onen there. So when you find me, you know you got me. And then Mañana No Más is my business. So anything Mañana No Más leads to me.
Yeah, we're going to wrap up the podcast part of the show, Matthew. So, Matthew, can you tell people where they can go to find out more about your articles and your thoughts, Matthew?
Sure. The best place to go is my website, which is MatthewRenzi.com.
That's fantastic. We're going to wrap up the podcast part of the show, but we're going to have extended bonus content. Where can you go to listen not only to the podcast, but also the bonus content? Go over to the WP Tonic YouTube channel and you'll be able to view the whole discussion. And also subscribe to the channel. That really does help the show. Another way you can support the show is to leave a review on iTunes or Spotify using the app. It's really easy to leave a review, good, bad, or indifferent, because it will really help the show and promote us to new people. We are growing. We're getting a bigger audience lately. I really thank you for that. And if, like I say, if you can leave a review on Spotify or iTunes, that will really help. We will see you next week for another great interview. We'll see you soon, folks. Bye.
Hey, thanks for listening. We really do appreciate it. Why not visit the Mastermind Facebook group? And also to keep up with the latest news, click wp-tonic.com/newsletter. We'll see you next time.